Let's get underway. Welcome to today's Parliamentary Library Lecture, the Australian Red Cross and the First World War. As you know, the library lectures bring distinguished speakers to the library to present on important topics of interest relevant to senators and members and the work of the Parliament. Today's lecture addresses Australia's wartime history and forms part of a wider series of lectures and publications by the library to commemorate the centenary of the outbreak of World War I, which was, of course, last year, and the centenary of World War I over these 4 years. We've titled the series A Deadly and Often Doubtful Struggle, Parliament, War and Empire, 1914 to 1918. We've also been honoured to have as previous speakers in the series Professor Joan Beaumont, Gary Oakley, Dr. David Stevens and Professor Peter Stanley, which I think is almost a roll call of Australia's most preeminent military historians of that period. Today I'm pleased to welcome Professor Melanie Oppenheimer, who will speak about Australian Red Cross in the First World War. I think the Australian Red Cross is something of a feature of Australian society, but like many, in preparing for this lecture, I realised I don't really know very much about it at all and where it comes from and its history. So I'll be most interested to hear the lecture. Professor Oppenheimer holds the Chair of History within the School of History and International Relations at Flinders University in South Australia. Among other things, her research interests include the role of voluntary organisations and patriotic funds in time of peace and war, her centenary history of Australian Red Cross, The Power of Humanity, this handsome volume, was published in 2014,
yes,
I think.
Yes.
And I believe you have another one, a co-published or a co-authored publication, The Last Great Battle of the War. Get that right, The Last Battle of the Great War, Soldier Settlement in Australia, co-authored with Professor Bruce Skates, if I'm pronouncing his... we expect that to be published this year, I hope. So, Melanie will speak for about 30 minutes, and then, as usual, we'll have a few questions. So please join me in welcoming Professor Melanie Oppenheimer.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to have been invited to talk to you today about the Australian Red Cross and its role in World War One. I hope you'll agree with me that this is an important topic. And I guess I'm a little bit biased. I've been researching and writing on aspects of Red Cross history for upwards of 30 years. I mean, when I actually add it up, it kind of frightens me a little bit. It's quite extraordinary that I'm still not finished with it. There is so much about not only Australian Red Cross, but the Red Cross movement more broadly. And I think that it is a topic that I encourage other people to. It's a very big space with plenty of opportunities. The Australian Red Cross was born out of war. A war that does have a very special place in Australian history, and is evidenced by your series. And we are commemorating the centenary of World War One right now. Now, officially, the Australian Red Cross was formed as a branch of the British Red Cross Society in August 1914. But in fact, this was 50 years after the original idea of creating an organisation of volunteers to assist the wounded in war was first formulated by a group of businessmen on the shores of Geneva in Switzerland. Now, these humanitarian ideals of what became the International Committee of the Red Cross were codified in the Geneva Convention in 1864. By 1914, the Red Cross movement included 38 national societies, with the Japanese Red Cross being the largest, with almost 1 million members. Now, I don't have time to go into it today, but maybe in questions, I might, if you're interested in this, in the book, which you may or may not have read, I commend it to you, I speculate in the centenary history as to why it took so long for an Australian Red Cross to be formed here in this country. So the mobilisation and exploits of the AIF is a well-known chapter in Australian history, but less well-known is the remarkable response of the Australian public and the impact that that response had on World War I. And I actually think you can probably draw connections with how we view volunteer work, unpaid labour today in our society in terms of, I don't think much has changed really. Now, patriotic funds, as they were termed, were formed in the hundreds on the home front during World War I, and donations poured in. And even those opposed to the war, you didn't have to be sort of, you know, patriotic to the flag, and of course there were many Australians who were opposed to the war, they could find a fund that suited their political purposes. There were funds to assist Australian soldiers and their families. There were funds to care for horses. There were funds to care for Belgian children. There were funds to provide musical instruments, funds to provide church huts for troops on the Western Front, funds that provided shiploads of meat and food to Britain. Now, this generosity went beyond donations of money. Many chose to volunteer their time and labour to the cause, and significant numbers of them did so by joining the brand new Red Cross, which quickly became the largest voluntary organisation in Australia. Now, 10 days after the outbreak of war, the Australian Red Cross was launched, established by this amazing woman, and I have to say that I think she is quite a remarkable woman, yet she doesn't actually have her own Australian Dictionary of Biography entry, for example. There's one on her husband, and she's just an appendage and a few lines. But it was really thanks to her that the Australian branch of the British Red Cross was established only 10 days after the outbreak of the war. She was the wife of our Governor-General, Ronald Munro Ferguson, and also the daughter of a former Viceroy of India, the first Marquess of Dufferin and Ava. So she had quite an interesting pedigree, which I'm happy to go into at another time as well. The objects of the Australian branch of the British Red Cross Society were formulated in accordance with the Geneva Convention. They were basically to supply hospitals, ambulances for the sick and wounded in time of war, to contribute to these people irrespective of nationality, to enrol people in the VAD movement, and also to render assistance in the case of a great public disaster, calamity or need. Now, Lady Helen allowed her home, Government House in Melbourne, because, of course, at that time, all the federal government structures were operated out of Melbourne. She allowed her home to become the headquarters of this new national society. Now, this is actually quite an extraordinary act, to open the doors of Government House. And I actually think it's good when you think about it, it was a very democratic act. And this included the magnificent ballroom of Government House. I don't know whether any of you have happened to go in. If you're in Melbourne and they happen to have an open day or there's a function on, try and get there and have a look at it. It is a remarkable room. And this place was the factory and warehouse receiving, creating and dispatching a multitude of Red Cross goods for the entire duration of the war. In fact, up until 1920 when Lady Helen went back to Scotland. The vast room, as you can see, was broken up into different areas, long trestle tables piled high with goods running the length of the room. The whir of sewing machines and the hum of industry replaced the gaiety of the violin and the waltz. Industrious volunteers assembled and packed Red Cross parcels. Others created bandages out of old linen, packed reading materials, or sorted the thousands upon thousands of socks and pyjamas that were sent by women and girls across the country. For over 4 years, upwards of 300 volunteers opened those gates and trudged up the driveway to Government House and entered the ballroom to work in the Red Cross Central Depot. Motor lorries and plodding draft horses and carts arrived with regimental regularity, either delivering goods or leaving piled high with wooden crates stamped with the distinctive Red Cross, ready for the docks and shipments overseas. Now, the Red Cross invasion of Government House continued. The dining room was taken over for meetings. The state drawing room was where goods were placed. Indeed, even the horse stables were requisitioned turned into a workshop where Red Cross goods, crutches, deck chairs, folding tables, screens, trays, bedside lockers were built. The staff of Government House were enlisted to answer telephone calls on behalf of the Red Cross. And you can imagine that some of these staff thought that this was a little bit much. And in fact, one of them stated that one day, one of these days, the Red Cross would have the Governor General out on the lawn. At the end of the war, the value of all these goods dispatched from the central depot, most of them shipped overseas, was estimated at over £1.2 million. Over the duration of the war, nearly £5 million was raised for the Red Cross itself and upwards of £15 million for the patriotic funds overall. Now, when the Red Cross became a household name, it attracted the support of particularly women. Now, you see these sorts of pictures in the libraries and things. There's many, many hundreds of them. And they're just, this one is an example of these sorts of women grouped together. This is the Scone branch in New South Wales in 1914. I particularly like this one because this is quintessentially Australian. It can only be Australian. And really, it's, I love the dog here with his ears pricked down there. And also, the shed, the setting. This is in a tin shed taken in Scone. The other thing that's interesting is that the women had to sew their own things and sew their Red Crosses onto their bosoms. Some people got a little bit enthusiastic. That wouldn't do today, I know. The Red Cross is very... The emblem is very important. And they wouldn't get away with it today. But women from around Australia, from Rockhampton, Yass, Beechworth, Kalgoorlie, they flocked to the Red Cross and they formed their own branches. And to give you an indication of these, by June 1918, in Victoria, the branches, there were 886 branches. New South Wales had 632. South Australia, 369. Queensland, 225. Western Australia, 148. Northern Tasmania had 108. And Southern Tasmania had 67. I didn't know when I started my research how Tasmania is separated into North and South. I know that there's a whole history there. There may be Tasmanians in the room who can illuminate them. But, you know, the idea that Tasmania was had two separate divisions, North and South. I don't know. The smallest state. Anyway. But these women were flocked to these branches and the membership was overwhelmingly female. And the sorts of things that they did, just to give you an idea of the sorts of materials that were lovingly made and then dispatched. Now, this went on throughout the war. The Red Cross was meticulous in itemising, as you can see, item by item, the numbers of blankets, pillows, pillowcases. But this is the sort of goods that were made because the army didn't supply these sorts of things to the troops, or particularly when they're in hospitals. You can imagine when a man is wounded on the battlefield, he doesn't carry a pair of pyjamas in his backpack. So when he gets to hospital and the nurses remove his muddied uniform and start to tend for him, they have to put them into something. And so the Red Cross provides that something, which is pyjamas. It seems quite obvious to us now, but of course in those days it wasn't. So these are the sorts of things. Flannel underpants, toothbrushes, and then, of course, well, toilet paper, preserved fruit, and whisks, mosquito netting, and glasses, cases of wine. So this just gives you some idea of the breadth and the depth and the amount of sort of materials. And this is just from Red Cross. Of course, there were other organisations doing similar things, dispatched to Egypt and the Dardanelles, March-September 1915. This goes on progressively throughout the course of the war. By 1918, the sultana cakes are packed for Australian soldiers with this sort of this seemingly unsatiable desire for not only women on the home front to keep it up, but also then that the need is there. And I think that that's something that's really useful for us to ponder now when we're sort of almost got centenary fatigue. You know, we've done Gallipoli. Oh, you know, God, we've got it under the Western Front now. We've got another 3 years of this. We're fatigued. Imagine what it was like for Australians 100 years ago. They had to keep this up, which they did. And in fact, they got better at it as the war went on. Lady Helen believed that the VADs were essential to Red Cross war work, and this is the particularly the image that is, when you think of Red Cross, you think of these young women. The idea proved very popular to young women. These were women who didn't have the need for paid jobs. There were many women in the middle classes. Their, you know, work opportunities were very limited. They couldn't actively participate in the war unless they were trained nurses. Many of them did then start their nursing training, but that took years. So the next best thing was to enlist as a VAD, a volunteer, unpaid, quasi-trained nurse. They worked either full-time or part-time, carrying out a range of quasi-domestic nursing duties. These images are from the number one rest home in Melbourne, which I believe is where the National Gallery of Melbourne is now, in that sort of area, just off the Yarra. Here they are, some of their patients, and the type of work that they did. This is in the laundry, in the ironing area of this particular rest home. The work was really housework on a large scale. They were really maids of all work, but they contributed in valuable free labour, enabling the Red Cross to undertake its range of its operations. So here, this is inside the rest home with the VADs there, and here is a nurse ready for their patients to arrive. Now, obviously, all this work requires money, even though you've got a tranche of unpaid workers for you. And so you had to raise money for the cause. And there were a multitude of charities and fundraising opportunities. There were continuous calls on the generosity of Australians throughout the war. So for this young society, it really captured the imagination of Australians very early on and really colonised a very important space. And this is just, there are fabulous sheet music in the National Library in particular. And what they did was that you'd buy these, you know, and play on your piano at home or in the church hall or wherever it happened to be, and it would go, proceeds to be devoted to the Red Cross. Viceregal patronage was very important, but so too was enlisting celebrities, such as Mae Gibbs, the writer and illustrator. I love this image. It's one of the ones in the book. And this is Sister Susie sewing shirts for soldiers. I can't say that. Here's Sister Susie here and all the little gum-nut babies knitting and sewing their pyjamas. And this was the beginning of her gum-nut career, as it were. These were made into postcards and things like that, but all for fundraising for the war. The other well-known person who was passionate about the Red Cross was Dame Nellie Melba, and she threw herself into the cause. Not only was she the president of her local Lilydale branch in Melbourne, but she really sang her way through the Great War. And she was encouraged to sing and not to knit socks, because apparently she said she wasn't very good at that. So they encouraged her to stick to singing and not to knitting. And throughout the course of the war, she raised over £100,000, literally just with her concerts. She really did a remarkable job. In her autobiography that was published, she has a lovely little... she talks about the knitting, and I'll share this with you. She says, on one of my first concerts after the declaration of war, I noticed as soon as I'd stepped onto the platform that almost every woman in the audience seemed to be knitting. The first bars were played of my accompaniment. They meant nothing to me. Still, that terrible clicking, that distracting flash of needles continued. And suddenly I stepped forward, I spread out my hands and I said, stop. Please stop. You are driving me mad. I know the soldiers will forgive me. So this idea that the knitting, the women were just knitting, constantly knitting throughout the war, on the trams, on the buses, in the Nellie Melba's concerts, no less. There are some particular days where the Red Cross came to the fore. This is Australia Day, not the Australia Day that we know, This was Australia Day, 30th of July 1915, to raise funds for the Gallipoli campaign. Really, by July, people on the home front knew that things weren't going well on the other side of the world. So school children, workers were given a half day or a whole day holiday on the 30th of July and to raise funds for the Red Cross and other organisations. And here you have these hundreds of school children. These are girls here and then Boy Scouts there in the middle, creating the cross at the Sydney Cricket Ground to raise funds for the war. But of course the Red Cross War didn't only happen here on the home front, it also involved overseas at the war front. So really, wherever the AIF was, the Red Cross and the Sallies, the Y, MCA, all the other voluntary, those particular voluntary organisations weren't far behind. And I sometimes think that our histories, we tend to lose sight of them, but wherever the AIF was, those groups in particular were just there as well. In July 1915, two Australian Red Cross commissioners went to Egypt to assist with the Gallipoli campaign. And they chose Adrian Knox here on the left. He was King's Counsel, a well-known lawyer. And here on the right, Norman Brooks. He was a well-known tennis player, won Wimbledon twice in the years leading up to World War I. So, Red Cross is a broad church. It really took their volunteers from many different occupations. And these commissioners, there were upwards of 60 all up throughout the war, who, in a voluntary capacity, basically had to administer and dispatch all these goods that were being made back in Australia. Now, of course, it wasn't without tragedy. There were many Australian women who found their way to Egypt and then later on the Western Front and to the UK because they wanted to help and do something for the war over closer to the Western Front. And a couple of them did lose their lives. And a couple of them are recognised in the cemeteries, but not many. And here's another one. Adele Brennan, a VAD, who died from the Spanish influenza in 1918. A couple of more well-known... I think Vera Deakin is probably one of the better-known individuals from World War I. She was, of course, one of Alfred Deakin's daughters, and she was the secretary of the Wounded and Missing branch of the Red Cross, first in Egypt and then later in the Western Front. She didn't actually establish it. I've been trying to get that out of the books. She did not establish the Wounded and Missing, in case any of you do know a little bit of this in detail. She was the first secretary. It was already established by Knox and the commissioners before she arrived. But that seems to get lost. It's like kind of some of the Anzac myths. No matter how you kind of present the evidence, the myths keep being perpetuated. But she did play an incredibly important role. One of the things that they did with the Wounded and Missing Bureau, which was basically set up for people from home to find out what happened to their loved ones because they couldn't get the information from the military. The way the Red Cross worked was that they had Red Cross searchers, again volunteers, in uniform, going out to the hospitals, going to where the troops are, asking them questions, do you know this man, do you know what happened to him? And apparently it was sort of like every 5 in 100 people that they questioned, they would get some sort of response. So it was a very laborious, very difficult task. Now, one of the interesting things about the Wounded and Missing is that there was also bureaus back here in Australia. And in South Australia is the only bureau where the records have survived. So the records of the prisoner of war that are in the war memorial are the records from the Vera Deakin ones from London. And the ones that have just been digitised as part of the centenary, Anzac Centenary, by the South Australian Library are the records from the South Australian Information Bureau. And they are quite exceptional. I've looked at 250 of the wounded and missing inquiries from the Gallipoli campaign. And this was one of the first inquiries that came in. Henry Alderson approached the Bureau in February 1916 after his son, Sergeant Lancelot Alderson, whose battalion left Egypt on the 10th of April 1915. And the family hadn't received any communication from him since. They believed he'd been wounded on the 2nd of May, and they had received conflicting correspondence from the military to say that, yes, he'd been wounded, yes, they thought he was on a hospital ship, yes, they thought he was in Egypt. Oh, actually, no, we're not quite sure where he is. We can't quite find him. So that's the spot, that's the point where they go and seek the assistance of the Red Cross. Within 4 weeks, with the assistance of the searchers and all the different sorts of framework that the Red Cross has established, Henry Alderson found out that, in fact, his son had been severely wounded on the 2nd of May on the Gallipoli Peninsula, that he'd been evacuated off onto a hospital ship, that he had died on that hospital ship. And because it was so acute and it was so chaotic in those days that they just buried through, the bodies were thrown overboard and buried at sea, basically. So there was no body, and the Red Cross was able to determine that for the Alderson family. But over a year after, in fact, that had occurred. So when we think about what was happening on the home front, particularly people, I don't think there was probably one family that wouldn't have had some connection with the war and some connection with people who knew someone who had someone who was particularly missing. And some of these people were missing for upwards of 2, 3, 4 years. And this is the role that the Red Cross did. Their tracing bureau still exists today. It celebrated its centenary last year, the Australian Tracing Bureau. So it's one of those things that the Red Cross continues to do. It's a very, very important, plays a very important role. At home, the Red Cross had a very close relationship with the Army Medical Services. And they donated huge amounts of money to set up the Australian General Hospitals. These are sorts of details that are just completely omitted from government-focused. You just sort of don't tend to get this sort of picture. But the Red Cross was, you know, not only donated people, labour, but also considerable amounts of funding. And here are VAs serving morning tea at Randwick Hospital. They opened up as soon as the men started coming back. Invalided soldiers were returning to Australia from July 1915 from the Gallipoli campaign, which then continues throughout the war in increasing numbers. The Red Cross establishes convalescent homes, specialising in convalescence and rehabilitation. Grand homes were donated to the Red Cross for the duration of the war, sometimes like Graithwaite. It was donated to the state of New South Wales in perpetuity to run, with the Red Cross running the home. And I don't know, there was a bit of a stoush a few years ago when the New South Wales government sold it to an unnamed local school, private school, for a figure that the federal government couldn't match in the millions and millions of dollars. But the Red Cross ran this home, convalescent home. Here are some of the continued to care for these thousands of permanently incapacitated ex-servicemen through the war and into the peace. And in spite of all the other things the Red Cross did after the war, the ex-serviceman and his family continued to be the main constituency for Red Cross work right up until the 1970s, because, of course, in 20 years you've got the Second World War and a whole new generation of men that need help and assistance. And I'll finish up with Private Kenrick Myers here. He was one of the hundreds of ex-servicemen cared for by the Red Cross at Graithwaite. Most of his skull was sheared off by a shell in the Dank and Muddy Fields of the Western Front, leaving him a paraplegic and unable to speak. Myers was invalided at home. He was then discharged from the army. Incontinent, unable to dress himself, he suffered epileptic fits and convulsions. He was quite understandably angry and depressed. His family were unable to cope with managing him, and so he was admitted in mid-1918 to Graithwaite Convalescent Hospital, where he remained until his death 16 years afterwards. Now, Myers is pictured here with Muriel Doherty. She was a Red Cross VA, and after the war, Muriel decided to train to become a professional nurse and went on to have a very distinguished career in nursing. She considered him her special patient that she looked after for many years. So to conclude, August 1914, I don't think anyone could have imagined how long the war would be and what a challenge it would be. but how it would change the country. When the peace finally came on the 11th of November 1918, Australians were exhausted and war weary. Now the boys could come home and people could resume their lives. But after 4 years of war, Australia had a well-developed, mature and highly successful national Red Cross society. Australia was still to face the devastating influenza epidemic that followed the war. But in short, although the war officially finished in 1918, the work of Red Cross continued. And I would suggest perhaps one of the positive outcomes of World War I, apart from the Anzac legend, is in fact the birth of the Australian Red Cross Society. So as we turn our attentions this year to the centenary of the Australian battles on the Western Front, and as I said, I think we are all a little war-weary. But despite that the years have passed, we're still learning more about that war and the impact that it's had on Australia continues to be re-evaluated. And I guess it's hard to assess the importance of Red Cross work, whether it made a tangible difference or not, to the war, either during or the outcomes. And I guess, as you can probably tell, I've only just scratched the surface today in talking about Red Cross in World War I. But essentially, through the Red Cross idea, it's a simple one. To relieve suffering from wherever it might come and whoever may be its victim. It goes to the heart of what makes us human. The creation of an organisation of volunteers to assist victims of war was one of the greatest and most ambitious ideas of the mid-19th century, and it's an idea that has managed to survive and flourish into the 21st. Thank you.
Do you have any questions for Melanie? Melanie over the back and then David.
Well, thank you, Melanie. I have an interest in the subject myself and worked for some time on Father Graham Butler. Of course, he's an official medical historian. But my question to you actually is about the Red Cross. As you said, and I'm aware, a lot of women did actually make their own way to Britain to because they weren't trained, if they wanted to nurse, because they weren't trained nurses. And some of them were members of the Red Cross back here in Australia. Can you tell me if the Red Cross actually kept records of the women who were members of the Red Cross and who went overseas?
The Butler history is it's really interesting. I'll answer your question, so just remind me to do that. But just as an aside, the Red Cross was told that they were going to have their history published after the war, and at least one manuscript was written, but it never saw the light of day. And what we had in the end was just that the one chapter in the Scott edition of the Home Front, which is kind of interesting in itself. It would be an interesting kind of little honours topic. I could find out, you know, what happened to that version, because I've actually quite found them. But in short answer to you, the Red Cross sent over a couple of groups of women. They sent over about 30 VADs, of which Adele Brennan is one lot, to work in the hospitals. They're the untrained ones. But they also were responsible for sending what they called the Bluebirds, who's the Elsie Cook lot, and they featured a little bit in that miniseries that was last year, the Anzac Girls. She was one of that lot. So they were official, properly trained nurses that were in response to what was happening in Verdun and the call. They were gifts for France, so they were sent to help the French. So those are two groups that were sent formally by the Australian or different divisions of the Red Cross. Records, there are some records of the Bluebirds. I wrote an article, came across when they let me loose in the New South Wales Division of the Red Cross Archives once. Well, archives, which is a cupboard, but, you know, it was great. And nothing better than just being let loose. And I found this box and found the Bluebirds and told that story in an article. The records of VADs, apart from the annual reports and minutes and things like that, that would be where you'd find information for that. But otherwise, you see, it was a free-for-all. You didn't need... It wasn't like World War II. By World War II, the government got their act together. No one, you know, you needed... You couldn't leave. It was much, much more difficult. World War I was a free-for-all. So if you could cobble together the money, And, you know, there's evidence where families pooled resources to get their daughter, who was a trained nurse, because she wanted to go to France or wherever. She'd missed the Australian Army Nursing Service thing. They got themselves there, and then they turned up. And if they had the skills and the training, they were accepted. So you find Australian women in all sorts of places. I mean, Miles Davis was in Salonika, and they're everywhere. But they are really, they're independent. There's no structure, no cohesion. And the problems too, and I will just say this, one of my bugbears, is that we lose women, because if they come back and then they marry and change their name, we lose them. So don't change your name, because, you know, historians can't find you. It makes it very, very difficult. That's what I tell my daughters. So that, you know, does that help to answer?
Yes, I'm particularly interested in. I've just had a book published on Elizabeth Kenny.
Yeah.
And of course, she wasn't trained, but she somehow or other. I mean, I know she got herself there, but I'm not sure whether she had what sort of type of backing she had when she arrived there. I know she was a member of the Red Cross in Clifton in Queensland.
Yes, she would have just. I think she wouldn't have had any formal. They would have just. But they would have seen her. She would have just taken herself off.
Yeah.
But she would have been seen as being on active service. That's how they saw it. You leave to go overseas to fight, to do your bit.
Yeah.
And if you're a woman, you can't get in the front line, so you do your bit. And that's how they saw it. I mean, Lady Helen says that the women of Australia were in the battle line, 8 months before the men, because they were there in government, you know, doing their knitting and sewing and creating all those goods and things. So they were doing their bit well before the men went into battle. I mean, that's how we have to understand how it was seen. But they saw themselves as being on active service, without doubt.
Can I just ask a supplementary before I ask my question? So are you saying that there was a draft of something for the official history that would have been part of the official history on the Red Cross, the bit that ended up in the Scott volume of the official history?
Yes, there's something floating around. In fact, I was only just, because I can't, you know, you just can't let this go. I'm on moving on to other things, but I can't let a manuscript was sent to Lady Helen. By this stage, she's Viscountess Navarre back in Scotland. Mm-hmm. Was sent to her in Scotland about 1922 mm-hmm. for her approval.
So somewhere there is a manuscript.
Mm. But her papers haven't been found. She is solely responsible for the extensive and fabulous Munro Ferguson collection we have here. She put together all her husband's papers on his death. What did she do for herself? So she knew the value of records. What did she do for herself? Nothing. So I haven't heard.
So there may or may not be papers that exist of hers somewhere.
I'm still hoping. Yeah, I've trawled, and I keep trawling, because one of the great things I want to do is write her biography, because she's just such an amazing person. I still hope maybe in her house in Wraith, in Scotland, that they're in, they're just in some kind of corner somewhere, tucked away.
In the attic.
Yes, but haven't quite got the, I've met the people, you know, the descendants who are in the house, but haven't quite got there. Because who cares? It's just a woman. She didn't have any children. You know, you haven't got these sorts of people that will carry this candle for you or the torch. But yes, so somewhere there could be a manuscript. Yeah.
Mm. My question was actually just about, can you expand for us just a little bit on how Red Cross went about finding out information about soldiers who got missing and what had happened?
Okay, well, they based it on the British Red Cross had set this up, a model at the outbreak of the war in 1914. So they were, by the Gallipoli campaign, they're well into it. And they send someone over to Egypt to start doing the same thing when it's the disaster that it is there. The Australians realise very quickly that they need to have their own staff, which is why they send the commissioners over. So they basically use that structure. But it's a very sort of prescriptive sort of, they've got a set of guidelines about what they're looking for, the questions that they're going to ask. They have these searches that they train, these volunteers, all men, that go out into the hospitals and wherever the men are, and they ask the... So there is they're very systematic mm-hmm. about their processes. The searches report back to Vera Deakin in Egypt and then London, mm-hmm. and then people. They then send the reports back to that each division had their own bureau. So the request would come initially from the bureaus here, Victoria, New South Wales, South Australia. And then that's how that would work. Generally, there was a sliding scale. You know, if you couldn't afford it, they would send the telegrams for free. It would depend. The work I've done on the Gallipoli, the bureau in South Australia, is that most of the people asking for details are women, and they're largely from the working classes, and the people that they're asking, the men that they're asking about, are largely privates and the lower ranks. I think the reason for that is that the upper ranks have their own networks and connections, and they also know how the military system works. From the correspondence that I've looked at, they're just people, the ordinary Australian, you know, who has a son like Alderson, goes missing, you know, the military can't give them any more information because they don't know, and they can't devote the resources because they're now already dealing with sort of the Western Front, is that they kind of, they talk to them in a language that people can understand. You know, they go to the door and they're greeted by, in South Australia, Florence Sanderson, who's the office manager, another woman. They're talked to, they're treated kindly, whereas the military system just seemed to be so, you know, large, and they didn't know how to operate within it. That's sort of what I'm looking at.
Thank you. Any other questions? Because I might jump in with one. Given that you had such a large number of people in a very organised environment, how large a role did they play politically or in an advocacy sense, both for supplying services during the war, but perhaps more particularly in the post-war period and all the repat systems and so forth?
They have the Red Cross, they have a very close relationship. It is an organisation that has, you know, the upper echelons of society in some very key positions. So the connections and the knowledge of how things work, and you get very important people taking up positions. I guess that's how these things work, and the Red Cross is still very good at that. But they really worked in partnership with REPAC. And the interesting thing is that, you know, when the terrific History of Repatriation came out a number of years ago, the Lees and No Escapes Move, that book, you know, they just, because it's a history about Department of Repatriation, they're not going to blow the trumpet of the voluntary organisations that were actually there in the field before they were established, because, of course, REPAC, it wasn't started until 1917. So my question is always, well, who was looking after these people prior to that? What was going on? And so through into the 1920s and 30s, it's a very close connection. You know, and REPAC gives the responsibility to the Red Cross for running these convalescent homes for the really difficult, you know, the most challenging cases, the most difficult cases, that even with Marina Larsen's work, that she talks about the families and how they cope with these men. Well, these are men that the families can't cope with, and so the Red Cross is there. And then, of course, within, you know, a generation, you've got the next war, and they're doing it all again. And they really are a very, very important... I mean, World War II, the records are better. World War II, that's what I did my PhD thesis on, actually, which is sort of kind of... I'm thinking, oh, that centenary's, you know, we're rapidly moving towards there, so maybe I might kind of dust that one off and get my head out of World War I and really into World War II, which I think is really interesting. Because the Red Cross... For the Red Cross, I've argued that World War II is really its moment. One in seven Australians were members of the Red Cross. It had a huge, it's, you know, if World War I was big, World War II is right up there. Right through the 1950s, really, then it sort of starts to sort of unravel. It's incredibly interesting, as you can, like, get a bit obsessed with it, really. But, so very close.
And another one, if I may, the Red Cross is, the Australian Red Cross is perhaps best known now for its role in training, in first aid training and so forth. Did that have its origins
way back in 1914, and with St John's Ambulance too. I have to mention them, but it's interesting, in Britain they had a much closer sort of relationship here. I don't think St John's Ambulance was as strong as it was in Britain nor in New Zealand, so there are kind of these little interesting national differences. So the Red Cross really comes in and becomes the dominant partner in that, but St John's Ambulance is also there as well. But, you know, it goes back to this war, And in fact, with World War II, basically, because you get so many of the same protagonists in the same positions, they just pick up where they left off. So, you know, it's sort of like, oh, right, fine, what do we do in World War One? Oh, right, fine, we'll do this. Except in the Second World War, the government, Australian government has a formal relationship with five patriotic organisations. The Red Cross, the Salvation Army, the YMCA, Australian Comforts Fund, and then the YWCA when the auxiliary WACs and WAFs come on board. So those five organisations have a sort of special status with the Australian, with the government during World War II.
Because as for the army, it must have been an enormous training task. Everyone's familiar with the idea of training military for the war fighting skills, but the number of people concerned in trying to be trained up to cope with the number of casualties and all the care roles is huge.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Do you
have
I'm curious about the. You mentioned the hundreds and hundreds across the of you know branches across the states and things like that. Just I'm interested in like the logistical challenge of integrating them all together. I mean, you said you know Government House in Melbourne was a great example of bringing everything together, but I'm sure there must have been other examples.
Now we're talking about the intricacies of the Red Cross of the Federation. Mm. How it was, each state was autonomous. And they set up their own, what they called, divisions. So, for example, New South Wales had its New South Wales division, and they really operated autonomously, independently of anyone else. But a national society can only have one head office. So that was the one that Lady Helen ran out of Government House in Melbourne. But already you have a problem, because not only then do we have Lady Helen doing her thing as the national body in Government House, you've got the Victorian Division just down the road with Lady Stanley, who's the head of that division. So Melbourne was too small to have the two, and there were a lot of shenanigans that went on between that fabulous tension between that too. And in fact, the national division, the national headquarters were meant to move to Canberra in 1927. There was a block, so I've never actually quite found it, but there was a plot of land where the Red Cross was going to, the building was going to be positioned, but because the Depression came and the Red Cross then had very little money, they stayed in Melbourne. But it's been a bone of contention because really, it's only there by a, historical accident. The national headquarters, in my view too, should really be in Canberra. And particularly New South Wales, this tension between New South Wales and Victoria is the two largest divisions, two largest states, and head offices in Melbourne, and there's all those sort of lovely things.
Some things never change, do they?
I know, exactly.
Ladies and gentlemen, I think we're out of time, so please join me in thanking Melanie. Now, just while I have you, as you will have noticed, the session was recorded, so you'll be able to watch it again at your leisure on the Parliamentary Library website, if you're so inclined. And we hope to publish the text of this as a seminar paper as well in the near future. And I'll also take the opportunity to advertise next week's lecture by the distinguished economist, Professor Bob Gregory, who will be speaking about migrants and jobs, Australia's amazing immigration decade. Thank you very much. This is almost a diminished quality to the photographs of that early period.
Yeah.